Evening, everybody. Nice to see you. Familiar faces, and less so. Nice you could come. So I want to give a Dharma talk. Before I do, I wanted to make one point about Zafu operations, how to operate a Zafu, which is if you're sitting in one of the cross-legged postures, seems to work, and you can try this, it seems to work pretty well to make sure you're sort of sitting on the very front edge of the cushion. So if you're kind of in the middle, you might want to kind of lift your rear end up and kind of slide yourself forward. So you're sitting at the sort of front edge of the cushion, and what happens is your pelvis tips forward a little bit, and that creates the sort of beginnings of a sort of natural curve so that you can really open the chest and extend the back of the spine kind of gently, you know, not straining, but just sort of feeling a gentle extension and rising up through the spine and where the spine comes into the neck. And one thing that's nice to do is on an inhalation, you can emphasize that extension and opening, especially when you first sit down. So inhale and get nice and tall. And then on the exhalation, just release tension. You know, let go of the shoulders. You know, if you're holding in the chest or the belly, try to release that a little bit. And if the back is upright and the chest is open, it's easier for the breathing to operate. So I just want to make that point. That you would think you'd kind of sit in the middle of the thing, but I guess they make all the back parts so it can kind of stick out in the air. I don't know why it's all there. You just sit on the front edge. So I wanted to speak tonight a little bit about, this talk is called Towards Wholeness. And I want to speak about wholeness and connection. And hopefully it won't be too long. I'm a little concerned that it's a bit long. Since I've had a sort of overly busy schedule for the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, I developed the ability to write talks really fast. Because I used to have like an hour or two max, you know, to write a talk. And so I'd whip out a 40-50 minute talk in an hour or two. But today I had like twice that much time. And I think I was probably moving at my usual speed. So I was just back there trying to chop it down a little bit. So hopefully it won't be too long. If it is, please forgive me and change your posture if it gets to be too painful to be sitting there. The sort of formal approach to Dharma talks is it's just like another period of Zazen, so you can play with that a little bit. You know, we're not too worried about being too formal, but that's the sort of formal idea, is that it's not like there's information or something you need to learn or take notes or remember. It's just sort of another way to be mindful, just in the mindful in the context of listening. So you can try sitting in Zazen posture, but if it gets to be too much, just be comfortable. So I wanted to bring up some teachings from a sutra called the Tathagata Garbha Sutra. And I also want to talk a little bit about psychology and about scientific studies of the mind and the body. So I have a huge agenda. But really, what is all this stuff about? You know, it's just about what is it, you know, to be a human being? You know, how do we do this? How do we do this being a human being, being a person? It seems like maybe all of human endeavor is about that question. How do we do this? Because we, all of us here, are basically more or less doing fine. We probably have our basic physical needs met. We probably all ate today. And yet, I don't want to talk about how we can be happier without acknowledging that there are many millions and maybe billions of people in the world who probably didn't eat today. So let's remember them as we consider how to live our life more happily and more fully in our fortunate circumstances. Because the other thing about being a human being that the Buddha spoke about and Western psychology investigates is, strangely, even though we all were able to eat today, we still have some problems. And people ourselves or people we know who are getting around and seem like they're pretty much just fine and can smile and shake your hand and tell you they're fine might not really be fine. There might be some deep troubles and difficulties going on for them. And this comes and goes for all of us throughout our life. If you are feeling particularly happy and balanced now, that's wonderful. That's great. But just wait, you know, things will change. And luckily, the same is true of the reverse. If you're having like a really difficult time in your life, that'll change too. So I want to start by thinking about psychology, and when you think about the psychology of human needs, and I'll have to ask the therapist later if people still, if psychology really agrees with this guy still or ever did, but I always think of Abraham Maslow. He's the founder, posthumous founder, I guess, of humanistic psychology. He died, I think, in the early 70s. And he created a wonderful hierarchy of needs, which I think is really applicable to us as practitioners. Because sometimes I think the way we approach spiritual practice is we think that we can kind of leapfrog over some of the basic human needs. That maybe it's okay if things aren't quite sorted out in our home life or this or that. If we just do spiritual practice, we could just sort of skip all that and be happy. It doesn't really seem to work that way. So I want to remind us of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And the way he described it is there's really a hierarchy. One is satisfied, and then you start to have needs in the next one, but it's probably a little more mixed together than that. It's like whenever they make discrete categories, it's probably not quite that way. So his first need is our physiological needs, as I was mentioning. Biological needs for oxygen, food, water, a healthy relationship to sexuality, a relatively constant body temperature. You think about that, you know, human beings can exist within like about 20 degrees Fahrenheit, you know. We have such sort of narrow band that we can survive. And these, of course, are the strongest needs because a person is deprived of all of these needs, they can't live. So first we have physiological needs. And then we have needs for safety once the physiological needs are met. And these are needs for security. And mostly we don't have too much awareness of our needs for security except when there's trouble, except in times of emergency or disorganization or when the social structure breaks down. But children are often more sensitive to the need for safety, and so you see this more in kids. We are convinced that society is basically stable and we don't worry about this too much, usually. But you don't have to look very much in the news to know there are many places in the world where one's safety is not taken for granted like it is in Bellingham, Washington. So that was the second one, needs for safety. And so most of us are probably doing pretty well. But then it starts to get a little more subtle. The third one is our need for love, affection, and belonging. This next class of needs for love, affection, and belonging emerge once physical and safety and physiological needs are met. And Maslow states that people seek to overcome their feelings of loneliness and alienation. That's the need, to overcome loneliness and alienation. And this requires giving and receiving love and affection and a strong sense of belonging. I think we probably all would say, well, I pretty much have that. But you can think of areas in your life probably that aren't quite the way you might like. Or you don't quite feel that sense of belonging like you might like to feel. Or you don't quite feel affection in the way you might like to. So that was the third of the five. The fourth need is the need for esteem. It says here, when the first three classes of needs are satisfied, the need for esteem can become dominant. This involves the need for self-esteem and for the esteem and respect a person gets from others. So we have a need to be validated and respected. Humans have a need for a stable, firmly based, high level of self-respect and respect from others. And when these needs are satisfied, a person feels self-confident and valuable as a person in the world. But when these needs are frustrated, a person feels inferior, weak, helpless, and worthless. And again, I think it's not sort of all or nothing, you know? I think we all have, in a way, a healthy self-esteem and plenty of esteem from others, but there might be areas in our life where we realize, you know, I sometimes do feel some shade of inferior weak or helpless, but maybe it's because there's not enough giving and receiving of esteem. So that's the fourth one. And the fifth one is the famous one, which I think he invented, which is the need for self-actualization. And Maslow describes self-actualization as a person's need to be and do what that person is born to do. So this is like sort of somehow touching on some deep sort of need that you are born with somehow or somehow have developed. He said, a musician must make music, an artist must paint, a poet must write. These needs make themselves felt in signs of restlessness. A person could feel on edge, tense, lacking something. But if a person is hungry, unsafe, not loved, accepting, or lacking self-esteem, it's in those cases it's easy to know what a person is feeling restless about. It's not always clear what a person wants when there is a need for when there is a need for self-actualization. So this is somehow like attaining one's potential or something like that. This is what children are wondering about when they think about what do I want to be when I grow up, and grown-ups too, I guess. And so here it gets a little more subtle. And maybe spiritual practice intersects this pretty directly. What do you really need to be actualized, to be fully yourself, one could say, or fully a person? And it's so easy to be confused, I think, about one's need for self-actualization. We can confuse someone else's idea of what we need for self-actualization with what we actually need. So this is a wonderful, enlightened thing from psychology, I think. And I don't really know psychology, so later the psychologist can straighten me out. So one thing about all psychology is that psychology seems to assume that there is a self to self-actualize, a self to have self-esteem, a self to interact with other independent selves to create these mutually supportive bonds that we need to achieve these five levels of need. So on the face of it, there might appear to be some conflict between psychology and Buddhism. Because, as you know, probably have heard, Buddhism is a little confusing, though. Maybe you've heard this, but it seems a little confusing. And you ask your Buddhist friends, and they're a little confused by it. Because Buddhism seems to say, well, there actually isn't a self. You are mixed up about that. A self does not actually exist in the way that you thought it did. Is not solid and real and permanent. Buddhism suggests that the self is a concept, a very powerful and well-developed idea, a conceptual framework that we lay on top of our experience, that we sort of impose on top of a very complex set of psychophysical phenomena that we're perceiving all the time, probably 100 billion perceptions per day, you know. Somehow we organize all that into the idea of a self so that we can function and make sense of the world. And of course, the only way that we can actually make this work, and cognitive psychology did some famous experiments and figured this out, is actually the way we make this work is we ignore most of the perceptions coming in. We only let in the ones that make sense to our sense of self. And so they can do these experiments where people completely don't perceive things because of the way their attention is working and the way they conceptualize. Like, I just read about a really good one. I didn't write it down, but I forget what it was. Somehow they got the subjects of this experiment involved and focus on one thing, and then they had this guy in a gorilla suit walk through the room and nobody saw him, you know. I forget how they got the person focused on something else, but it was that kind of thing, you know. You're doing something that makes sense to you and you're engaged in it, and someone with a gorilla suit walks through the room and you didn't even see it, you know. The photons must have hit your eyeballs, but it didn't get into your brain. And anyway, Buddhism suggests that we don't just take this on faith, you know. No, somebody's not telling us we don't exist. We should check it out with practice, with meditation practice and teachings and awareness practices. And Buddhism suggests some analytical tools, different ways that we can categorize and reconceptualize and notice more sort of minutely and precisely what's really arising in each moment. And so instead of saying, this is just me walking down the street, you know, perception of breeze on the face, perception of this, feeling of that, you know, memory arising, we can start to sort of peel things back to a more moment-by-moment basis for experience and little by little realize, well, there's not exactly a me there, you know. There's things happening. There are things being perceived, but is there really a me there? Sooner or later, you kind of can't find anything that's a me, that's a you, that's a self. And so therefore, it might seem like Buddhism is saying, well, forget all about Maslow, you know. Why would you go to all this work to take care of yourself if it doesn't exist? And if you try that, you will really suffer, and you'll find out that that doesn't work either. You can try that, though. People do, you know. Usually at, like, bigger centers, you know, where it seems like it's really hardcore. People come and try to get rid of their self, and they really suffer. Because it turns out the only way that we can soften up about ourself, because it's the rigidity of self that causes so much of our suffering, the only way we can really transcend and be soft and loose and gentle with our sense of self is if our sense of self is really in good shape, is really well taken care of. If all five of Abraham Maslow's levels of self-actualization are really being met. And like I was saying earlier, sometimes people think they can use spiritual practice as kind of a shortcut. But what happens is, as you do spiritual practice, your self-awareness increases almost inevitably, you know, no matter how so-called good or bad you are at it. Your self-awareness increases, and things start to arise in the mind that maybe you hadn't thought about, or maybe you were ignoring or repressing. And you start to notice the places where your need for self-actualization, or your need for love and belonging, or even your need for safety are not fully being met. And you start to realize, you know, I can't ignore that anymore. That's hurting me too much to not take care of my life fully. I can't skip over what I need, even though there's not exactly a me that needs it. It just works that way. And what Buddhism is really interested in a moment-by-moment basis, is not what's right or what makes sense, but what causes suffering, what causes joy and release of suffering. And if you do some experiments in your life, you find that ignoring your basic human needs causes suffering, and so you have to attend to them. So in a way, you can come to spiritual practice thinking, I'm going to transcend the self, and then realize through your spiritual practice that actually you have to take much better care of the self as part of your practice. Now, psychology is very interested in also in easing suffering, in analyzing how we came to have the different tendencies and issues and psychoses and neuroses and all kinds of C's that we have. Buddhism is not so interested in figuring out why things happened as carefully examining how they happen and what they really are. And so we tend to say, you know, pain and suffering, I don't want that. I'm going to run as fast as possible, or do whatever I can to suppress or avoid or remove that pain and suffering from my life. But Buddhism suggests, well, why don't you not be so quick about that? Why don't you stick around in pain and suffering for a minute and see what's really going on? Maybe you can learn to engage and interact with pain and suffering in a more nuanced and intelligent way, and thus be more effective in reducing suffering in a meaningful and lasting way. And so the Buddha came up with a theory from his practice, handed down to us over all these years, I guess, of three levels of suffering. And suffering is maybe, you know, it's sort of hard sometimes to get these things to work out right in English. They used a word, they actually use phrases which have a common root. And the root word is a Sanskrit word, dukkha. And it usually gets translated suffering, but suffering sort of sounds a little, like, too big. So these are the three levels of dukkha, three levels of suffering. The first is called dukkha-dukkha. It's easy to remember that one, dukkha-dukkha, which is the pain of pain, the pain of pain. So these are obvious pains, you know, physical pain, illness, aging, and the additionally psychological and mental suffering, you know, when we're upset, when we don't like things, when things are not the way we want, when we're bereaved, when we're mad, when we're angry. These are dukkha-dukkha. Physical, immediate physical and emotional and psychological pain is dukkha-dukkha. And basically the understanding is that some amount of dukkha-dukkha cannot be avoided because you're a human being in a body with a mind. It's just the way it goes. But it turns out, if we look more carefully at what we think was dukkha-dukkha, it's actually a whole mix of other things too. On top of the physical pain are many other levels of experience which we add to that experience to make it much worse for ourselves. So it's useful to know about the second and third level of dukkha so that we can start little by little to distinguish. Oh, you know, like for instance, you go on a long meditation retreat, there will definitely be some pain. Sorry, it just happens. But then what you start to notice is like there's pain in the knee, but then on top of pain in the knee, I start to have anxiety, a sort of formless anxiety, like, is this good, is this bad? And then I start to wonder, am I causing permanent damage here? Is this like kind of a masochistic thing? What am I doing here? Why am I at this retreat? You know, these other people are probably like really, you know, and pretty soon you're in a much worse state than just a sensation in the knee. And so what you're adding are these other levels of dukkha. So the second one is called Viparinama dukkha. And this is the suffering born of change, the dukkha of change. So this is really important, actually, and something we're a little bit in denial of all the time. And we all know perfectly well that everything is changing, right? We know that all of us are changing and every existent thing is changing and nothing is permanent. But we don't really live as if we fully understood that. We live as if there's always tomorrow. I can always get to it later. My friends and family will always be around. And so it really shocks us when seemingly suddenly they get sick or they die. But actually everyone's changing and everything's changing all the time. And so the suffering born of change is our sort of denial of that and resistance of that, our sort of blindness to that, such that it seems to happen to us in these sort of painful little gaps and starts because we weren't watching it as it went gradually along. You know, suddenly it's sort of, there's enough change that we notice again. Oh my gosh, you know, she's getting older. How'd that happen? You know, she wasn't older yesterday. I didn't notice that. And so the Buddha taught a lot about fully engaging our understanding of the complete changing nature of all phenomena, and that if we ignore that or are in denial of that, there's a lot of suffering. So that's the second level of dukkha. And the third level of dukkha is a little more subtle yet. And this is called samskara dukkha. And so to explain samskara dukkha, I have to explain the word samskara and talk a little bit about Buddhist sort of psychology. So samskaras are conditioned things, assembled things, things that come together from other things. In other words, samskaras are like basically all phenomena that we can perceive. So when you get angry, some combination of factors is coming together in your mind and anger arises, you know. When a seed is planted, some combination of factors in genetics and water and sun and all these things come together and a plant grows, right? And these things happen and you can kind of take any psychophysical thing, and Buddhism doesn't make so much of a distinction that we do between physical things and mental objects. And if you look at it carefully, you can see it's made of other things, right? Like atoms, you know. Molecules. What's inside a molecule? What's inside an atom? What's inside that? And so how does that connect to suffering, you might ask? Is Buddha saying that everything that exists is going to cause suffering. That doesn't sound like very good news, you know. What he's saying is something like, when we see objects, it's connected to the second one. He's saying something like, when we interact with mental and physical objects, we interact with them as if they had intrinsic sort of reality. And we think they can be depended on in a certain kind of way. And we sort of depend on them in a way to give ourselves happiness and satisfaction. And what he's saying is actually the nature of all existent things is that they are constantly coming and going and reforming and changing, and it's sort of a more subtle and fuller version of the second level. That everything that exists has a sort of quality of fluidity and more than impermanence, so kind of impermanence beyond impermanence. And so one way to think about this kind of suffering is the way that we go around trying to make sense of things. Like you hear about people trying to find a better balance in their life. Well, I've been working on that. I've been trying to find a better balance in my life. You know, we're constantly trying to conceptualize and make sense of things as if they were sort of existent and solid. And what the Buddha is saying is things are so much radically more fluid than that. So whenever we try to make sense of things in a way that sort of our happiness hinges on, we're going to be let down. Things are going to turn out to be a little different than we thought. They're going to change. Things are going to die. Things are going to be not what we thought. Everything's going to kind of rearrange. It's almost like you try to make sense of things and things kind of settle down in your mind. And we've all had this experience, you know, and you're kind of going along fine. And something happens and it's like, I don't know, it's like you're like a snow globe or something. Someone just shook you all up again. You know, it's like you're in a blizzard and you can't see what's happening anymore. You know what I mean? So that's sort of one way. It's a little bit hard to talk about the third level of suffering. It's the suffering born of a limited view of reality, I suppose, is one way to look at it. And it's a suffering that can't really be engaged with by thinking or conceptualizing. It's a suffering that's engaged with directly through spiritual practice. So these are three levels of dukkha. Simple, pain, dukkha-dukkha. Pain from suffering from change, viparinama dukkha, and this more subtle sort of suffering of existence and our misunderstanding of existence, which is samskara dukkha. So I think the interaction between Maslow's hierarchy of needs and Buddha's teaching of these three levels of suffering seems to be, one way to look at it is, even if your Maslowian hierarchy of needs was well met, this is where it gets interesting and why there is spiritual practice. So you've got food in your belly, you've got love in your heart, you're confident in yourself and your abilities, and you're doing what's most deeply fulfilling to you, and all your relationships are wholesome and wonderful. And it's funny that saying that sounds like a joke. You know, why does that sound like a joke to us? It's kind of sad, anyway. You know? Why would that not be our natural sort of state as human beings? But anyway, let's assume that that was fully possible. Everything was great. And yet, there's still some sense there, you know what I mean? Even when everything's going great, there's still some sense of something not being quite it. And I think human beings have tremendous abilities to get busy and occupied and ignore that feeling. You know, that sort of feeling, that niggling feeling at the back of your neck. You know, the hairs in your back of the neck are just kind of twitching a little bit, even though, you know, it's like a wonderful evening and you're having a wonderful time with your partner and everything's just perfect, but there's just this little, you know what I mean? This little sense of dis-ease. So why is that? Why is that? And that's where samskara dukkha is helpful. It helps us to have some concept to work with what's really non-conceptual so that we can turn towards that and eventually, through our practice, put that to rest too. So we can let ourselves off the hook a little bit. And you're like, well, of course I feel a little dis-ease or samskara dukkha just like everywhere, you know? No big deal, you know? I can work with this. Because from a psychology point of view and a sort of human point of view, without those teachings, then it seems like we're broken. You know what I mean? The machine is getting all it needs, should be running perfectly, but there's like a little catch in the mechanism, you know? The human machine must be broken in somehow. And that really is upsetting. So it helps to have some teachings and some way to engage with very subtle levels of dis-ease. And as I understand it, conventional psychology sort of drops off at that point. It's sort of out of perfect unconditional happiness is sort of out of scope of psychology. And not to belittle psychology, I think it's just, you know, naturally, it's a human science, and that's it, just can't go that far. Psychology, I think, is interested in people becoming, you know, reasonably happy, which would be great. It would be wonderful if everyone in the world was reasonably happy, well-adjusted, and maybe a little resigned to the little problems of life. Just basically, okay, right? I'm okay. You're okay. So I think spirituality has something to add, but it cannot ignore psychology. It would be a mistake. And psychology also, so far, most mainline branches of psychology are not very concerned in a direct way with our physical presence. Like I'm sure your therapist might suggest it'd probably be a good idea to exercise, but they're not intimately involved with your physicality. Psychology is interested in the mind, how we think, how emotions and thoughts interact, how our history, colors and conditions our thinking, and so on. If there's a physical problem, you should go to the doctor. And science, of course, by its nature, you know, its great power is specificity, is looking carefully at one thing, and so it is very compartmentalized. Its great power is a focused inquiry into one area with one set of tools. And so psychology just doesn't really have the tools to engage with the body, and doctors don't really have the tools to engage with psychology. And neither of them seem to be engaging with something beyond that. So I thought, continuing on a science kick here for a minute, we'd look at an interesting sort of area of science that I've been reading about a little bit lately, which ties these together a little bit. So science is not oblivious to these connections. So I want to tell you a little bit about behavioral medicine. It's not really the best name. It sounds like the medicine of how do you behave or something like that. But it's behavioral medicine is concerned with how people's thinking and attitudes affect their health. And it's been something that's been, you know, active research since the 60s. So it's not a new thing. But strangely, some of the things that are very clear from behavioral medicine studies we do not take to heart that really would affect our happiness. So I want to bring up a few of those things and then get back to Buddhism. And then hopefully there'll be time for discussion. We'll see. So I did not do an exhaustive review of the scientific literature, obviously, today, but I did read some things about behavioral medicine in a book by Jon Kabat-Zinn called Full Catastrophe Living. And he starts out his section on behavioral medicine by telling a really powerful story. A story told to him by a man named Bernard Lohan, who is a cardiologist, about something that happened to him when he was in his training. Here's what Bernard Lohan said. He saw when he was a young med student. And this is really interesting. He said, "This experience still provokes in me a shudder of disbelief. Some 30 years ago, I had a postdoctorate fellowship with Dr. S.A. Levine, professor of cardiology at the Harvard Medical School. He was a keen observer of the human scene. He had an awesome presence, was precise in formulation, and was blessed with a prodigious memory. He was, in fact, a consummate clinician at the bedside. Dr. Levine conducted a weekly outpatient cardiac clinic at the hospital. After we young trainees examined the patient, so people are coming in to get looked at who have some kind of heart condition, after we young trainees examined the patient, he would drop in briefly to assess our findings and suggest further diagnostic workup or changes in our therapeutic program. And with patients, he was invariably reassuring and convincing, and they venerated him and listened to his every word. And in one of my very first clinics, I had as a patient Mrs. S., a well-preserved middle-aged librarian who had a narrowing in one of the valves on the right side of her heart, the tricuspid valve. And she had been in a low-grade congestive heart failure with a modest edema, a swelling of the ankles, for years, but was able to maintain her job and attend efficiently to her household. She was receiving digitalis and weekly injections of a mercurial diuretic. Dr. Levine, who had followed her in the clinic for more than a decade, so he's known, you know, they've been, she's had this condition for more than a decade working with this doctor, greeted Mrs. S. warmly and then turned to the large entourage of visiting physicians and said, "This woman has TS," and abruptly left. No sooner was Dr. Levine out the door than Mrs. S.'s demeanor abruptly changed. She appeared anxious suddenly and frightened and was now breathing rapidly, clearly hyperventilating. Her skin was drenched with perspiration, and her pulse had accelerated to more than 150 beats a minute. In re-examining her, I found it astonishing that the lungs, which a few minutes earlier had been quite clear, now had moist crackles at the bases. This was extraordinary, for with obstruction of the right heart valve, the lungs are spared the accumulation of excess fluid. You know, that shouldn't have been happening. I questioned Mrs. S. as to the reasons for her sudden upset. Her response was that Dr. Levine had said that she had TS, which she said she knew meant terminal situation. I was initially amused at this misinterpretation of the medical acronym for tricuspid stenosis, but my amusement quickly yielded to apprehension, as my words of explanation failed to reassure her, and her congestion continued to worsen. Shortly thereafter, she was in massive pulmonary edema, so a big heart attack. Heroic measures did not reverse the frothing congestion of her, in her heart. I tried to reach Dr. Levine, but he was nowhere to be located. Later that same day, she died from intractable heart failure. To this day, the recollection of this tragic happening causes me to tremble at the awesome power of the physician's word. That, huh? And you could also say the awesome power of anybody's word, you know, the power of words and thinking. So I might skip over some of the many studies I'd written down to tell you about, but because that kind of tells it all in a way, you know, just that one example. But they've done many studies, placebo studies you've heard of, where the control, one group gets the medication, both groups are told what the medication does, half of them get a sugar pill, and it's been shown over and over again that the people getting the sugar pill show some effects, some of the same effects of the drug every time. Sometimes that effect approaches the actual levels of the people who got the real drug. So how could that be? Regular medicine can't explain that. Also studies about optimistic and pessimistic people. And they have, you know, they have to define these terms. But basically, optimistic, happier people are much less likely to get cancer, to get heart failure, to get all kinds of diseases. This has been established. They've also established that people with a strong feeling of connection to others are much less likely to get major diseases, including cancer, and that if you do get cancer, your feeling of connection and optimism greatly seems to greatly influence or correlates with, they don't really know what the causative agents are, but a positive attitude correlates with a much better survival rate to cancer with cancer. And one can't talk about behavioral medicine without bringing up type A. So we've all heard of type A, so I was so excited to finally find out what type A was about. You know. Maybe you all know this, you know. Elizabeth went to med school, maybe I told her about it. But so it turns out, I'll tell you about type A. You've got to know about type A. Then you can be more accurate when you call somebody a type A, you know, asshole. You know. So it turns out to be a term for psychology that was coined in the 1950s. And it gained a lot of credibility from a large study in the early 1960s in England, I think, of a large group of men. And they grouped these men into type A and type B personality types. Type A's being people driven by a lot of urgency, competitive, hostile, aggressive, maybe some sense of insecurity. Type B's being easygoing, less urgent, more contemplative and relaxed. And so anyway, this big study in the 1960s very famously found that type A people, so they analyzed all these men, several thousand men, and then 8 years later they got them back in again to check for signs of heart disease. And they found that type A's develop heart disease 2 to 4 times the rate of type Bs. So it really does make a difference. And there are later studies which question the whole type A, type B thing, and does that really make sense? And it might be just some subset of the type A personality type, like hostility, that's really doing them, really associated with the heart disease. And there's probably lots of other things that they could find out. And one of the things that he points out in the book is that these are pretty expensive studies to do. You have to like measure several thousand people and then 10 years later check them again. And so it's hard to do. But how does all this go together? Psychology suggests that once basic physical needs are met, we have a range of emotional needs that have to be met, especially if we can heal from past traumas and work skillfully with our problems, we can be pretty happy. So that's one thing. Early Buddhism suggests that we can work much more subtly with our feelings of discomfort and pain and learn a lot more about how we create the world with our thinking. And then behavioral medicine suggests that how we feel about the world and how connected we feel to ourselves and others is basically a life or death matter. We will get sick and die much earlier if we are not connected and whole and balanced in our emotions and our feelings. So what do we add to this? What can we do with all this? And what does Buddhism have to offer the rest of this psycho-physical emotional world? The first thing, I think, is that we realize through our practice that there's plenty of work that we can do that is not about thinking. It's not even exactly about emotions. It's not about figuring things out. That there is work we can do that is beyond concept, that is beyond self. There is some feeling that we can cultivate in our practice that allows us to have these positive qualities, but to have them not as something we possess, but to exhibit these positive qualities as a natural outgrowth of a life that's broader than a feeling of just me. And we can only do this by actually doing it. We can't talk about it or think about it in any effective way. Zazen, meditation practice, is a lived experience done with the whole body mind. So I think that's one thing we have to offer the psychologists and the scientists. So there's something beyond all that, something you can feel in your heart. And allowing yourself to feel that feeling might be the way to allow those positive affects to arise. You can't tell an angry person, you should just cheer up, right? Have you ever tried to do that? That does not work. But you could tell anybody, please sit down and notice your breathing. If they're too angry, maybe they won't do it, but maybe they'll do it later. See what happens. The second important thing I think we have to add to all this from Buddhist practice is that the idea that we are a broken machine that needs to be fixed up, that we are lacking something and need to go find things, that we have things we need that we need to discover, that is sort of an endless chore. It may be true in a way. There are ways that we are broken, that we can fix things up. But that if that were the whole story, we would be on a treadmill, running until we die. What Buddhism has as a counterpoint to that is that it's also true that there's nothing we need to fix up. That we are complete as we are. There's no fine-tuning that is needed. There's nothing new we need to learn or figure out. That we are whole. We just forgot. There's some confusion on the surface of our wholeness, but it's possible to feel the feeling beneath that surface, and we feel that we are whole and complete, that we are Buddha. We are awakening. And there's a whole sort of school of Buddhist thinking and teaching about this, and I want to read you a little bit from one of the famous sutras about that. the Buddhist teachings on wholeness. On the one hand, in our lineage, we have Dogen, who teaches powerfully about this with his concept, his idea, and practice, that we aren't practicing to get something. So it's Dogen's sort of main big point. Dogen being 12th century Japanese teacher, founder of this lineage. Other Zen teachers around were saying, well, you need to practice to get enlightenment. He said, no, no, no. And his teacher said, no, no, no. You're already enlightened. You're practicing to manifest that enlightenment, to experience and fully live that enlightenment. You're not even doing practice or enlightenment. He sort of glommed the words together. You're doing practice enlightenment. So we have Dogen saying that. And then we also have this wonderful teaching of Tathagata Garba. That's what I was trying to get to through all this. Tathagata Garba. I want to read you a little bit from the Tathagata Garba Sutra. But first we have to talk about the title. Because it's in another language. What does it mean? You know? Tathagata, and this is interesting actually, there's two different ways to break those two. It's a compound word, tata and gata or agata. And depending on how you break it up, it either means thus come one or thus gone one. It has both meanings, thus come one and thus gone one. So it's the one who just comes and the one who just goes. So the Tathagata is able to just come and go. So change is not a problem. Impermanence is not a problem. Suffering is not a problem. There's just this. Nothing missing in just this, just coming and going. And just coming and going is the only way you can just be, it turns out, since you can't be in a solid way, in a permanent way. So that's Tathagata. And Tathagata is also another one of about 40 or 50 names for the Buddha. It's another name for the Buddha, Tathagata. And we say Tathagata in the chant before the lecture, I think. So that's what it means. It means Buddha, but also has this meaning of just coming and going, just existing. And Garba turns out to have a much broader range of meanings, all of which have to do with containers and things inside, especially hidden things. So Garba can be a womb, but it can also be the fetus inside the womb. It can mean a hidden room or a sanctuary, and it also can mean a treasure inside that room. Garba can mean a husk, you know, around a seed or the seed itself. So it's a very fluid word, having to do with things that are obscured or contained or not seen for what they are. So as you probably figured out, it's a sutra on the way in which our wholeness, our awakened nature, is hidden from us. The way our Tathagata is Garba. And it says that if we receive good teachings and have faith in them, we can really increase our confidence in our true nature, in our true essential wholeness. And so it's a nice sutra because it's a set of similes. There's 9 of them. I'm going to read you 2 or 3 of them and a little bit from the introduction. And later we should study the whole sutra because it's quite wonderful. It'd take 3 or 4 classes probably to really do it justice. So a little bit from the Tathagatagarbhata Sutra and then a little, I hope, time for a discussion at the end. Everybody hanging in there? Okay, good. So to set the scene, we have the Buddha. And this was probably not exactly what the Buddha said. Sorry. And there's all religions, you know, have sort of waves of teachings. And to be legitimate, they always have to be attributed to the original teacher, right? So Jesus definitely said everything in the New Testament, and Buddha definitely said every sutra. But, you know, probably not. So this was probably composed in the 3rd century Common Era. But nevertheless, the Buddha was there. So we have the Buddha. He's seated in meditation, very powerful meditation. And he's surrounded by hundreds of thousands, it says in there, hundreds of thousands of monks and bodhisattvas. So it was a really big room. And to get things started, he created a vision. He conjured a vision, you know, because he's really powerful. Meditator, you know. It says in the sutra, At that time, the Buddha sat up straight in meditation in the sandalwood pavilion. This was a lot of sandalwood, huh? Imagine you had that much sandalwood. And with his supernatural powers, he put on a miraculous display. There appeared in the sky, so you have to picture this, a countless number of 1,000-petaled lotus flowers, each one as large as a chariot wheel. Really big flowers flying through the sky. Countless numbers. Each one filled with colors and fragrances that one could not begin to enumerate. And in the center of each flower was an image of a Buddha. And the flowers rose up and covered the heavens like a jeweled banner, each flower going, sending forth countless rays of light. So you with me here? Flowers flying, countless rays of light. So beautiful, you know, like awesome. And the flowers all simultaneously unfold and then wither in an instant. And then within the flowers, all the Buddha images are sitting cross-legged in the lotus posture, and each one issued forth countless hundreds of thousands of rays of light. So the flowers fall apart, these Buddhas are floating around, lights are shooting out of their foreheads. And the adornment of the spot at the time was so extraordinary that the whole assembly rejoiced and danced ecstatically. And in fact, it was so strange and extraordinary that all began to wonder why then all the countless wonderful flowers were suddenly destroyed. And then further, the flowers withered and darkened and gave off a smell which was foul and loathsome. So that got their attention. And you'd think that hanging around with the Buddha, all these bodhisattvas would have seen many miraculous displays, but this was a really good one, I guess, because they were really confused and they, like, delegated somebody to ask the Buddha what that was all about. And he explained that he had to get their attention, give them a very important teaching. And so he gives the teaching in a series of similes. So here's the first one. Good monks and nuns, it is like pure honey in a cave or a tree, surrounded and protected by countless swarms of bees. It may happen that a person comes along who knows some clever techniques. He first gets rid of the bees and takes the honey, and then does as he will with it, eating it or giving it away far and wide. Similarly, good sons and daughters, all sentient beings have the Tathagata Garbha. It is like pure honey in a cave or a tree, but is covered by kleshas. Kleshas are defilements. Anger, ill will, jealousy, you know, insecurity, all the unfortunate mental things are kleshas. The kleshas are like a swarm of bees, and they keep one from getting to it. But with my Buddha eye, I see it clearly, and with appropriate skillful techniques, I expound the Dharma in order to destroy the kleshas, smoke out the bees, I guess, and reveal the Buddha vision. And everywhere I perform Buddha deeds for the benefit of the world. And then he gave a long poem saying the same thing all over again, which I will skip in the interest of time. But there's a nice rhythm to these. They do prose and then poems and prose and then poems. You can kind of get into the rhythm after a while. And here's another one. Or, good sons and daughters, it is like the genuine gold that has fallen into a pit of waste. And I don't know if the translator was being nice. It might have actually said shit, you know. Could be. You know, like there, well, you know, like this, there's no indoor plumbing, right? So, you know, there's piles of waste around. And then submerged, and the gold has not been seen for years. Pure gold does not decay, but no one knows it is there. But suppose there came along someone with supernatural vision who told people, within that impure waste is a genuine gold trinket. You should get it and do with it as you please. Similarly, good sons and daughters, the impure waste are your innumerable kleshas. This is not just a few, innumerable kleshas. The genuine gold trinket is your Tathagata Garbha. For that reason, the Tathagata expounds the Dharma to help you out. And both these are interesting because they remind us that we need help. We don't realize that there's gold inside of that pile of shit, you know, or there's tasty honey behind those angry bees. So we need teachings and tradition and support to reach in there, you know. Let's see, one more. This one's nice because it mentions our bodies. Our bodies are important. Or, good sons and daughters, it is like a store of treasure hidden beneath an impoverished household. The treasure cannot speak and say that it is there, since it isn't conscious of itself, doesn't have a voice. So no one can discover this treasure store. So it's like buried underneath the hearth, you know. There's all this money, but you're broke and don't have any food. It's just the same with sentient beings. But there is nothing that the power of the Tathagata's vision is afraid of. The treasure store of the great Dharma is within sentient beings' bodies. So this is buried inside our bodies too, he says. It does not hear and it is not aware of the addictions and delusions of the five desires. So our pure essence is not defiled, cannot be defiled. No matter how messed up you are, how many terrible drugs you're taking, your Tathagata Garbha cannot be defiled. The wheel of samsara, of regular life, turns and beings are subjected to countless sufferings. Therefore, Buddhas appear in the world and reveal to them the Dharma store of the Tathagata in their bodies. And they believe in it. They accept it. And they purify their universal wisdom and their intentions. Everywhere on behalf of beings, the Buddhas reveal the Tathagata Garbha. They employ an eloquence which knows no obstacle on behalf of the faithful. In this way, good sons and daughters, with my Buddha eye, I see that all beings possess the Tathagata Garbha. And so on behalf of Bodhisattvas, I expound this Dharma. So that's our marching orders. To see this in ourselves and really feel it. And to be willing to show others, to remind others. There's more right in you than there is wrong. Yes, you're suffering and your basic needs aren't being met. We need to investigate that. Let me help you with that. But meantime, let's not forget. There's gold in there. There's a wonderful Buddha in the middle of all that, no matter what's happening. So, I don't know if I have any clear conclusions from our little adventure here. I guess I'm just trying to say that we're really lucky. We have some real opportunities. We inherit from two powerful traditions, East and West. And we can use these teachings of psychology and body medicine and Buddhism to really decrease our own suffering and help others. I guess the one specific point I wanted to make is to encourage us to really practice with our bodies, really notice whether we're taking good care of the body, feel the body, practice through the body, not sort of be dragging the body around like a chore we have to deal with, but fully live in the body and enjoy the body. So, thank you for listening so patiently. As I feared, we don't have as much time as I wanted. But let's do a little experiment in having a short discussion about this. We only have 5 or 6 minutes, so if we were to like kind of all talk together, we wouldn't all get to talk. But let's try this. Let's try having a short conversation with a partner, if that's okay. So we'll find a partner, and we'll each have 2-3 minutes, I'll ring a bell, to speak. Not very long, so let's just try to see what the one thing that comes up for us is, and we can bring it up again later. And let's bring up this question, taking turns speaking. When you're speaking, just saying what seems true for you, not trying to impress anybody, just speaking. And the other person just listening, nothing you have to comment on or say, just listening. Let's bring up the question of wholeness. Are you whole and complete? What do you think prevents you from feeling whole and complete? Or maybe, what's the sort of next step for you? What do you need to do next? What's the next thing to practice with or work on or let go of in your journey towards wholeness? Because maybe that's really what the human life is. It's a journey towards wholeness. Should we try that? Is that okay? So find a partner and spread around the room and make quick like it, because we don't have much time. And then just settle in together. Introduce each other if you don't know each other's names. And let's just try having a little experimental conversation. You might want to spread out a little bit so you don't hear the people right next to you. It can be a little distracting. You want to be able to hear your partner. And let's start by just sitting silently for a few seconds. I just threw a lot of words at you, so let's just let there be a little bit of silence before we fill up with more words. Just let things settle. And just kind of bring your focus down to the center of your body, to your heart, and just feel for a moment. And then after that, I'll ring the bell again, and the first person can just start speaking for about 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, so let's just try that. First, just breathing, not trying to figure out what you're going to say, but just letting go for a moment. Okay, first person, what comes to you around this topic of wholeness?